We believe the future is voice, video, intonations, body language, all that stuff. We want to get to all of it. In our small beginnings now, our goal is a little more basic. We want to be able to help you ask better questions so you can get better answers and make better decisions.
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solenox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the AI Advantage. I'm your host, Solomon Williams. We have a special guest today. We have Anatoly Shilmink. He's the co-founder and CEO of CogBias AI. So, Anatoly, thank you so much for coming on to the show. I'm really excited for this. Can you just tell us just a little bit about yourself and introduce the audience of like who you are and then what is CogBias AI?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, first and foremost. My name is Anatoly Shilmink, and I am the co-founder CEO of CogBias AI. We are the first platform that's dedicated to detecting and mitigating cognitive bias in our communications. Now, cognitive bias are, you know, we kind of have heard the term, but not a lot of people know what it really means. The best way to kind of define it is we are the linchpin to help you make better decisions. Because quite often what ends up happening is we ask questions that, you know, force us into positions where people will always confirm our worst things. So for instance, do I look fat in these jeans? Who will say no? Who will say yes? Who will say no? Those are the sort of things that you really worry about. Quite often when you do customer discovery, product discovery, when we're designing new products, when we're doing any kind of decision-making that leads forward, we base it on data from the questions that we ask. So we created a platform that automates the process because humans are not machines. And because of that, we have faults. We will not be able to detect everything. We will not be able to know everything. That's where we come in.
Okay, perfect. And I love that. And in terms of that with the bias and so forth, as that you've been able to kind of find the gap, what really inspired you, like Anatoly? Because I know you just before, you've partnered with Savvy Tinker Studios, you've kind of worked with other parts and being a partner. What really inspired your mission for CogBias and seeing that?
I mean, honestly, we all have cognitive biases. That's how we function, right? Every single day, if we had to try to detect everything that's wrong with us, we'd go crazy. So I never really had the experience, behavioral science background or anything else. No, how it really came about was I saw it in action. When I finished business school in 2009, and here I am dating myself, but in 2009, I finished business school. I was hired by a large pharmaceutical company to run one of their well-known brands, and that was Theraflu, the cough cold brand. And I came in at the end of a three-year project, roughly, which was the Theraflu flu detection kit. The concept behind it was very basic. We were going to utilize a new system to help people to figure out if they had the flu. Sounds very basic, very simple. And that way they would know if they had to go to the doctor, get prescription medications, all that stuff. I had a chance to see some of the focus groups and focus studies. And at that point, I really didn't have a background in behavioral science to really be able to say like, oh, something's wrong there. But at the same point, you know, just like all of us kind of have almost a built-in BS meter, you kind of say like, huh, something's wrong here. And some of the questions really kind of made me wonder. I'm like, well, who would say no to this? Nobody would say no to this. The way this was asked, of course they would say yes. And, you know, when questions were like, would you want to know if you had the flu or do you like going to the doctor? There's only one kind of answer. I don't think anybody really likes going to the doctor. And I don't think anybody would say, no, I don't want to know if I have the flu. So those are the questions that are a lot of things are based on. You end up with a particular thing. And in this case, you ended up with a BS sandwich. Because up to that point, by the time everything was said and done, $20 million was invested in the development of it, the focus and research studies, the pre-manufacturing, and it was canceled. Why was it canceled? Because some of our bigger customers did their own panel studies, and that's a type of focus research group, where their questions were focused more on the idea of, would you spend $19.99 to find out if you had the flu? Now, when less than 4% of all people said they'd think about it, that's when you know you have a problem. And that's a very blatant example, but it's a real one, and it happens every single day with companies everywhere. It happens with us all the time. If we even go into the idea of technology startups and early stage companies, why do they fail? Hardly ever because the product doesn't work. It's always, almost always, because there's no market need, because the customer doesn't want it. And you'll always hear the excuses, well, they just didn't understand it. I'm like, I'm fairly confident they understood it. The problem is, if they don't want it, they will not necessarily tell you that. If you ask them questions, which put them in the position to, you know, kind of go along with the flow. But they will never sign the check, and they will never approve of the purchase. And that's the big difference. So seeing all that come together, for us, you know, as we progressed in 2017, I entered an accelerator called Flashpoint at Georgia Tech. It was a very unique accelerator because its focus was not on, could I program a good product? Could I create the new technological innovation? Its true goal was to figure out if I could achieve authentic demand. Could I get the customer to not let me leave the room before they made the purchase, before they made the next thing to guarantee a purchase? That means I had to figure out, how do I ask the right question? How do I figure out what it is they really, really, really want? And it was all based on the idea of behavioral science. You know, there's many famous books out there. One of the more well-known ones is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And the concept has always been the same. If you ask people questions, quite often you're going to lead them to confirm your thesis. And that's not necessarily a good thing. Sometimes it's obviously directionally can be correct, but quite often it's going to give you the impression that certain things are correct. And so, you know, when I did the accelerator, and for 6 months, you were forced to think differently, talk to hundreds of people and resist every base impulse to ask a question that would totally make you feel good. You know, quite often you had to basically let them take you for a ride and figure out where their conversation would go and see if they're reaching for something that you could give them. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. But it showed, it allowed me to start understanding this is where we go wrong. And so fast forward to 2022, 2023, I known Savvy Tinkers for a bit, and they were looking at creating a venture studio. And so they involved me in the concept for a fintech product. And while we were playing around with starting to build up the fintech product, we quickly realized, based on our experience with Flashpoint, that we were going to ask the wrong questions. This is guaranteed. We're human. We know we're going to do it wrong. So we had to try to figure out, how do we solve this problem? So our chief technology officer, Chris, had a very early version of ChatGPT. And he said, well, you know, I did something like this 15 years ago, but with a much bulkier AI, when he was trying to use artificial intelligence to figure out if he could detect suicidal tendencies. And suicidal tendencies are forms of biases. They're rational beliefs based on lived in or perceived experiences. And, you know, we were able to execute it. And this was very basic. It was based on ChatGPT, so not very reliable, not very workable. But once we went and, you know, kind of played around with it, it's like, okay, we have a good customer discovery tool. Let's go and do customer discovery. When we talked about the fact that we built an internal tool with some of our friends who were product managers, they said, well, you should show it to us. So we went to an event for a well-known organization known Product Coffee. And mind you, we didn't really have a true name. We didn't really have an account system or anything else. We didn't have a website. This was not what you think it was. You know, this was literally us just like, look at the cool thing we built. And we had a ton of people interested. We had something like 70 startups and 36 signups in 36 hours from the people that were present or observed we are online, except they were sending us their information via email or sending us pictures of the signups. And that's when we realized we had something on our hands. And that was 2+ years ago. But we also realized at that point what we were building was extremely unreliable. So we had to build our own way. So we moved away from the idea of using the ChatGPT, Claude, or any of these big LLMs in any kind of a decision-making capacity. And why we did that is because, well, you know, we've heard all the ideas of hallucinations and BS and all this other stuff that AI tends to do. And, you know, it's been consistently across the board that AI for cognitive biases has somewhere between a 30 to 50% reliability rate. Now, what does that mean? That means sometimes it'll detect the bias, but it will not figure out the true meaning of it or how it works with your context. In other cases, it'll figure out the context, but not the true meaning of the bias, and how to rephrase it better to be more effective. So it's always a mishmash. So we created our own expert data models, which allow for closer to 95% reliability. So that gives you directionality. It allows you to rephrase the questions you're asking, rephrase the emails you're writing, do all the things that are important that, you know, make it better so that you can get deeper insights from the information you get back, because that's ultimately the goal. Everything we're doing is obviously for the idea of, if you have the right data, the deepest insights, you would make the right decision more often than not. And that's the goal.
And, you know, so for that, you know, I really liked kind of even coming in from your experience when you were at the Georgia Tech and you're at the accelerator program and, you know, as you kind of evolved and created your own, it, you know, it seems like with it's asking, as you said, the right questions and obviously, you know, digging a really deeper. So I'm curious from add that accelerator learning, taking in to grow your, you know, expertise as this leader, as the CEO and as founder and implementing this in the cog bias. What are some questions that you see like where that you've learned and just over your career, just your life that people aren't asking and that you're thinking of that when putting this into the AI?
You know, one of the biggest things that quite often people get confused about is how come AI is biased, mm-hmm. right? It's a machine. Well, the best way to kind of understand it is it's designed by humans. I mean, we build the dang thing. And so because of that, there's a lot of, you know, our own frailties fall in there. Initially, if you consider it, I heard from some folks who were kind of on the ground floor when OpenAI was working with a few others. And it's like, you know what people base a lot of LLMs on? Not everything, but kind of the base concept. It's the idea, if you, and this is me aging myself again. Back in the 70s and 80s, there used to be a show called The Jetsons. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of knows The Jetsons. They said they based a lot of ChatGPT's personality on the Rosie the Robot. Not directly, but the idea that was the inspiration. It had to be helpful, overly helpful. It always had to, it has a little bit of cheekiness to it, blah, blah, blah. But it always has to be helpful. It has to give you a solution no matter what. And there's been a lot of papers that have been written on the idea of hallucination and everything else. My favorite one is called the ChatGPT is BS. And it's an actual research paper. And what they wrote is very basic. You know, hallucinations are not really what they are. What they really are is BS. We all have that friend that thinks they know everything. And they will always have the answer, even if the answer is completely incorrect. And they will die on that hill to tell you that it's correct. ChatGPT does the same thing. It'll tell you the answer. It'll make up the precedence for it. It'll make up the proof for it because it's dying on that hill. And no matter what, it will never tell you that it doesn't know. And as we saw the release of ChatGPT 5.0, the trend continues even greater. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, companies like OpenAI and Google, et cetera, they're not building specifics. They're building generalities. They're trying to figure, for Google, if you can imagine, Google's the end-all be-all in search. Well, now the end-all be-all in AI is that for general use is what they're fighting over. And that really creates this dichotomy. So when we're considering, like, what are we putting into our system, the reliability aspects, we know we're biased. So we know humans designing AI will create some biases. We have multiple different methodologies we're using through experimental psychology. And that's where our chief science officer, Matt Altobelli, comes in, where we try to eliminate all the biases from the perspective of, what if it's a bunch of guys building an AI? What if it's a bunch of women building an AI? We create a mix. So that way, yes, will it have some frailties and some biases? Yes. Will we be able to detect them and filter them out so it doesn't impact its ability to work with you? Yes, we can do that as well. Is it 100%? No. But is it over 90? Absolutely. And each month we're getting closer and closer. And I don't think we'll ever get to 100% because, you know, there's such thing as diminishing returns. So you were jumping first 10, 15% at a shot. Now we may be jumping 0.1, 0.2% at a shot. But the goal is the same. Create that reliability element. So quite often we ask ourselves, what's the bigger goal? What's the bigger thing? You know, a lot of people have these grandiose goals. Our goal is kind of simple. We want to eliminate bad decisions. It's an insanely grandiose goal, but it impacts every single aspect of life and industry you can think of.
Yeah.
On the commercial side, you can think of things like marketing, or consumer research, user research, etc. Now, look at healthcare, the diagnosis of diseases, diagnosis of conditions, pain threshold considerations. We always heard the stories and the research studies that show that women are quite often judged differently for their pain threshold versus men. And it's been proven that it's due to bias. And if we can eliminate those aspects or have the system ask extra questions before a medical professional, you know, passes their judgment, those are the sort of things that are important. And those are the big things that we want to achieve. And obviously, when we're talking about foundational things, you know, we want to get back to the idea of being able to detect suicidal tendencies. We think we're close. And yes, there are systems out there that can detect it in text, but we believe the future is voice, video, intonations, body language, all that stuff. We want to get to all of it. In our small beginnings now, our goal is a little more basic. We want to be able to help you ask better questions so you can get better answers and make better decisions. And then on the bigger piece, we want to be able to filter out any of the biases or hallucinations or whatever you want to call them of AI agents and LLMs that are being pushed out now. Because every single day, probably there's thousands upon thousands of AI agents being put out, which is just instances of an LLM. And their flaws are exacerbated quite often. And, you know, whether it's in mental health counseling, whether it's a banking app that has that deals with consumers, if an AI agent starts deviating from the programming and the prompts that you gave it, you might not notice until it's too late. Right now, we can look at it post-mortem. In the next year, we're going to be able to do it in real time because we'll live inside that agent. We'll have a plugin for that. So those are the big goals. And those are all the things we're always considering as we're building, as we're making the next business decision. It has to be something that not serves you in the next week. That's important. But what does it do in the next year, next 5 years? Like, how does it serve the grand design?
And, you know, with it, I really liked on, as you said, like everybody in nowadays, especially with this market, how everyone, a generalist isn't what's needed. It's someone that's a specialty, specialized. And I think that's the key part. And it seems like for the cog bias is helping those, you know, being more specialized into that industry and asking those specific right questions. Is that fair to say?
That's very much fair. I think that aspect, you know, is understated, to put it mildly. I think when we look at what the future holds, and I've been asked a lot about the idea, well, you know, AI is going to replace people. I'm like, no, not even close, honestly. If anything, if we consider looking back at history when horses were more or less eliminated for cars, everybody thought, oh my God, all those poor horseshoe makers and, you know, riders of the horse buggies and all this other stuff, what are they going to do? And the ranchers. And I'm like, well, with cars now, you need somebody to make the parts and you have to repair the cars and build the cars. So it's the same exact thing. In this case, what AI is doing with us, it's making us better editors. So the ones that will make it, the ones that will thrive are the ones that are great editors. The ones that can look at the data that the AI is providing, look at all the stuff that's being put in and make the decision that's correct. You know, it's funny, a few weeks ago, I had a chance to speak with Eric Brooks. Eric Brooks is an incredibly legendary figure in the world of finance. He founded a $600 billion investment firm called Susquehanna International Group. But his side project, his side quest, if you will, and now that he's, you know, more or less retired from SIG role, is decision science. In particular, his focus on decision education. And we had a discussion. He kind of mentioned something very interesting to me. He said, you know, if we look at what the future holds, and it's like, and you don't have to be an AI expert or anything to kind of get to this idea. Well, yes, is it going to be helpful for us to know history? Absolutely. Is it going to be helpful for us to know math? Sure, why not? But is it going to be important? Not really, because we're heading to a point where we're going to have wearable AI everything that's going to know everything. What AI is not going to be able to do is make good decisions. It'll make some decisions, some basic ones, but human decisions are extremely complex. And our ability to make decisions and figuring out how to look at the data before us and make the right decision is more crucial than ever. For instance, so his organization's mission is to add decision science and decision education into the K-12 curriculum, starting at kindergarten. Because they said that the element is the same. Machinery and technology will change things and evolve things. Our ability to make decisions of when things are right and wrong is the thing that needs to evolve. We can learn all the AI we want, but if we're incapable of spotting things, of understanding what the process looks like, we're going to be making the same key mistakes over and over. And that's like a big belief in my world where, like, for instance, even the way I, you know, went about gathering the team together. My goal as a CEO, and I think it should be every CEO's goal, is to be the dumbest person in the room. I always hear everybody's like, well, you have to be the smartest person in the room. I'm like, no, you have to surround yourself with the smartest people in the room. You have to gather people who are such experts in their field that you have no notes for them. The reason why is because if I knew a ton about decision science and then I needed a chief science officer, that would be a terrible experience because I'd have a point of view that goes beyond things. And so all those things as we are considering, like the decision making we make, we always constantly look back at what we're building and using it actually to make our own decisions and to help us guide our decision making. Because ultimately, you know, there's no such thing as an overnight success. I know we always hear about with AI, oh, 3 months, they were able to make $100 million in ARR. I'm like, no, you didn't see the years of development that took before that. You didn't see all the stuff that went before that, that, you know, was quiet. You only saw the commercialization part. And yeah, sometimes there's this incredible supernova trajectory. But the more realistic one is the ones that start, you know, it begins with a slow burn. and then slowly starts taking over. Because if we consider things like Microsoft or some of the big, legacy companies that we have now, in the 70s, Microsoft was a storefront in New Mexico. People don't know that, but that's the thing that people don't understand. So you start off small, surround yourself with really smart people and keep getting smart people. And even if you're building a technological thing that will outpace people, ultimately it's people that are going to be the ones to figure out if it's good enough. And it's people that are going to be making purchase decisions. I know I've heard a million stories about AI to AI corporations, where a corporation's going to hire an AI and purchase from an AI and make all those decisions. And who knows, one day it'll happen. I have a hard time believing a lot of humans are going to stand by and watch that happen too often. Yeah. It's the same as autonomous cars. You know why we don't have more autonomous cars? It's a very basic thing. Unfortunately or fortunately, humans are used to the idea of human error. When we get into a car accident, they're used to it. Like, this guy was not paying attention. He was on a cell phone, didn't yield for somebody, something. There's a reason. What happens when an autonomous car crashes into an autonomous car? What's the question then? How did that happen? As AI, they're supposed to know everything. Who's responsible? So for us, again, decision-making kind of falls into that, right? There's got to be a human in the loop ad nauseum for a very long time to come. And we're trying, and our goal with our system, our platform, is to keep the human in the loop. Because ultimately, the one thing we don't want our system to do is to make the decision of what the right question is to ask. We make a recommendation, we make a suggestion, but we will never touch the point of telling you, this is the only way.
And you kind of even brought up, even with the human error stuff that we're kind of used to, I can only imagine just on the insurance side, we get to this.
Exactly.
Like, that would be insane on that. But, there's one side of just the transits over that you brought up a really good point, but I want to kind of go back just onto your style on the leadership is on. Exactly as you said, and you're starting in, bringing in a team. So now you have to think of exactly as you said, you need to have the smartest people, right? You don't need to be a smartest person. So that in terms of your CTO, them being able to know the architecture, like the deeper things, and then having that. So I know sometimes I kind of seen that sometimes you label yourself as a civilized pirate, right? on the sides.
Yeah.
About what do you mean by that? What is your definition of the civilized pirate and where it came from? And then secondly, with you being the CEO, and I think this is a really common question for other startups and people that are coming into it and now thinking on this side, what does that day-to-day look like and what do you think they need? Because it's such an overwhelming task. What from your experience have you think those people should kind of emulate or think on building like their enterprise or their startup? Does that make sense?
Sure. I think the first thing is don't read any of those lists by so-called successful people of what they do in the morning. It's all a bunch of nonsense. Especially, it'll always make you feel like you're inadequate and you're not doing enough. And I can promise you it's all nonsense. I know some of the people about whom those lists were printed. And I was like, oh, dude, you really get up before in the morning? It's like, that's a bunch of nonsense. I never, ever got, I told him that because it sounded good. He's like, I sleep till 9. First of all, there's no such thing as a day-to-day. And I think that's important to understand that because especially in the early stage, there's nothing that's not in your job description. There's also nothing that, above or below. The idea is always like you're playing catch, right? You're trying to catch everything. And it's important to understand you will not catch everything. For instance, some people will be like, oh, you have to hurry up with your business development pipeline. You have to hurry up with hiring people. Well, fundraising. Oh my God, no fundraising. I think honestly, as a CEO, as a co-founder, first of all, you have to figure out, do I have the right team around me? At the beginning. And then figure out, what does this team look like in a year? Now, you will never be accurate. That's the thing. That's important to understand. It's all flexible and fluid. But the idea is to understand, do you trust your co-founders? This is probably the most important thing. If you are alone, a solo, that's fine. I think it's very difficult. But usually you'll need somebody as a sounding board, somebody who's an expert in something that you're not. But the first and foremost is, in order to be surrounded by smart people, you have to trust them, right? My CTO, I trust that he's going to do his CTO responsibilities. I don't need to ask. They know what they got to do. They have a plan. And there's no formal education for any of this stuff. Like, let's be clear. So for anybody wondering, I have no technology background whatsoever. My degree was in packaging science. I'm the guy who could make your cardboard boxes. I designed those things. I just love solving problems. whether it's technological or anything else. So the key, first and foremost, don't start with the ideas like, oh my God, I don't know technology. Do you see a problem? Do you think that you are the one to make a solution for it? Good. That's a good start. The next phase is obviously start at the very beginning. Am I asking the right questions? You know, the formation of a company is a very sensitive thing because, hey, first of all, you're putting yourself out there, you know, and you're registering something. Now you're revealing your idea to the world. And being top secret, I don't believe in any of that. You know, I think obviously you're not going to go running around telling them the secret sauce to your business. But at the same point, you'd be amazed how many people want to help and will offer good advice. The key is for you then, back to the decision making, right? Figuring out how you absorb that data and what's good advice and what's just advice. And you can listen to it and it'll still be good advice because you heard it, but you don't necessarily have to follow it. But the biggest pieces are going to be the same, the right team. So you got yourself your one full co-founder, two co-founders by yourself, whatever it is. If you're by yourself, make sure you have a good set of mentors and advisors around you. You need somebody to sound off of. You do. Being in your own echo chamber is brutal because you're going to question, either you're going to be like, I'm the greatest, I'm the smartest, which, you know, we all are, obviously, or it'll be the other way around where we're going to doubt ourselves over and over again. The other piece is do not compare yourself to anybody. Yes, there is a 21-year-old that just turned down a $250 million acquisition. Yes. You know, in the moment it took me to say that sentence, Jeff Bezos just made more money than I'll probably ever see in my life. And that's okay too.
Yeah.
That mental aspect is the key because most of the time, like, look, it's being a founder in the early phases is a whole lot of lows and a few highs. The key is to understand that the lows are just a journey. It's not like, oh my God, this is the worst freaking thing ever. There's some days where it seems nothing works, right? Like I'll do outreach. I'll do try to connect with people. And you're like, I have achieved nothing today. I'm a failure. No, you're not. This is literally the process. And you always think like, oh my God, these people are so busy. Let me give you a real play-by-play. Most CEOs, most real CEOs, they don't work more than a couple hours a day. True work. What is the rest of the time? You're having lunch with somebody. You're having coffee with somebody. You're getting on a call. Is that really work? Depends on how you look at it, right? We're not digging ditches here. And that's important to understand because it means you also have to have respect for yourself. You have to understand that you don't have to be up till midnight. If you don't have work till midnight, you don't have to force the issue. And people will say, well, there's always work. I'm like, there is always work. There's also such thing as diminishing returns. It's like I always looked at the world of finance and I always thought of the investment banking analysts were doing 90-hour weeks. And I always used to laugh at that because when you do the breakdown of what they did most of the day, up until 5 p.m., they did very, very little. They went to the gym, they had coffee, they went out for drinks, da-da-da, because they would only get their assignments at basically 5 p.m. from the managing director, and then they'd be working till 1 a.m. It's the most backwards system ever. The inefficiency is startling. And that's what I'm saying. There's nobody that really works 16 hours a day. They will say it, and they will something, oh, I'm 16 hours a day. No, you're not. Listen, you went to the gym. You had coffee, you went and grabbed dinner. By all arguments, I'll say I work 16-hour days because, you know, if I'm out somewhere for meetings, I'll come home, I'll see my kids, I'll play with them, I'll take them to the baseball practice. But then because I finish, because after they go to bed and I do a couple more hours of work, oh, well, I was working from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. No, you were not. And that's important. Like the work-life balance thing, I always found it weird. I don't recommend for people to necessarily disconnect. I think that's a mistake. I think the bigger thing to do is to flow with it. You know, that means that when you're with your family, you're with your family. When you have the free gap time, that's when you can fill it in with something else. But the idea is always to make sure that those things are balanced because we always hear about there's a mental health crisis with a lot of founders because there's a lot of pressure, right? In some cases, you're, you know, more or less everything on the line. And I always recommend one thing to founders. And, you know, I've been fortunate where I've been a mentee and I've been a mentor. And the biggest thing I always tell other founders is this. I'm like, you have to start with the concept that nobody wants your product. And that's okay. Because if you start there, you can start evolving it enough to figure out how to make people want it or how to find out what people actually want so you can build it. But if you come in with the idea like everybody wants this product, you'll be in for a disappointment when you go on that customer discovery and discover that they're not reaching. And that can be a very depressing thought in your head about how to work through. And that completely will impact all your productivity and what you have to do. The other piece I always tell people is the same. If you went to college, utilize your alma mater. It's incredibly important. It's amazing how many people I hear about, they went to whatever school, some way better schools than even I went to. And I was like, well, He's like, I'm having a hard time finding some interns. I'm like, have you talked to your school? What do you mean talk to my school? Talk to your school. You know who would love to help an alum and at the same point get some internships for their people? Your school. And chances are they're very smart kids and they'll do the job and there's going to be a deeper relationship there. For us, you know, I've been fortunate. I went to Rochester Institute of Technology. We have a really deep relationship with them now. Considering, look at us. We're an early stage company. We have not actually commercialized that first product yet. But yet we already have 7 interns running out of Rochester Institute of Technology. We have a consistent pipeline of them. All we have to do is shout. We'll have 40 resumes within 6 hours. Why? And you would say, well, every startup could do that and take away your talent. I'm like, they could. But realistically, what they're looking for these days, the interns are looking for these days, yes, they want money. Money's great. Well, as an early stage startup that is operating on a bootstrap budget, we are not in the habit of paying market rates. We can't. So what do you offer? You have to offer a unique opportunity to work on something cool. Because ultimately, let's consider all the internships anybody's ever had in their lives. How often were they actually exciting or interesting? Very little. So the opportunity to work on something interesting will almost always outweigh the idea of going and putting in your 10 hours a day for X amount of money. And we've been fortunate with that. By utilizing all the resources available to you, it's amazing how you can build without burning. And always start with the idea that nobody's going to give you money. They won't. And that's okay. In fact, it's great. You control your vision. You don't have to answer to anybody but the people working with you and your customers. It's a much better point of control. I'm not saying you shouldn't go seek investment and all this other stuff. I'm just saying the vast majority of the time, investors don't understand. Why don't they understand? Because they're not really good at what they do. I know it sounds weird, but it's the truth. Think about it. Their success rate is 10 to 20% most of the time. Why is it so low? Because they're all biased. How are they biased? Well, I invested in a guy who went to this school last time. It was pretty good for me, so I'm going to do it again. That's the entire thesis. It's remarkable. Or, you know, they'll invest in a specific thing. Or obviously they will, you know, we can talk about all the percentages of minority investment, women investment. That's all stupid. Because if anybody ever claims to me that they're a good business person, I quickly say to them, so yeah, I looked at your portfolio. You're basically eliminating about 50 to 60% of the entire demographic pool, brilliant founders, right? Because of your thesis. That's not a good business person. And I'm kind of annoyed by all the performative impact funds out there because I'm like, let's be clear. You're investing in a specific founder because it's a good business decision. As a CEO, if I'm hiring somebody, I could care less what color they are, what orientation they are, what their deal is. Even what school they went to is kind of irrelevant to me. Why? Because none of that matters. They could be extremely book smart, have gone to Harvard. And they could be completely useless in the thing. So all those things you're building up, eliminate all those things. There's too much noise out there about founder this and founder that. I'm like, no, your experience is uniquely yours. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't like read some books and figure out leadership styles and things that you agree with, don't agree with, etc. But I actually made a point of not reading too many leadership books. Why? Because I kind of realized that it's organic. You'll kind of understand how you fit in. You'll start seeing it. And if you push too hard, or if you read a book about like Steve Jobs, who was honestly an awful leader, like people don't understand, Steve Jobs was awful. Like an awful human being who just was right place, right time, incredibly smart people, right? He was very good at pushing the envelope and saying yes to insane things. But as a culture CEO, whatever, he was horrific. Apple had some of the worst culture you ever experienced in your life. But that's not the point. But now in the hindsight, everybody's like, oh my God, legendary CEO, so incredible, such an innovator. I'm like, he did not invent the iPhone, guys. Somebody else invented the iPhone. He just said yes, which was his job. His entire job is to say yes or no. As a CEO, that's where the buck stops, right? And it applies the same to everybody else. So your style has to be organic. You can mimic other people, but what that really will do is it's not you. You're now going to be playing some kind of a part. And that also will add extra pressure on you.
Right. And you've touched on so much. I would like love to dive in on just the time that we have. But, I really think that you put on a really good approach to it. And I already see how cog bias can even just help with this because, to your point, it's you get so caught up into, you know, wanting to learn from different books and so forth. And I feel like people, you that becomes a bias in and of itself, because you're having to learn, everyone's saying one thing, you need to do this, you need to do that, and there's this bias, rather than, as you've said, it needs to, and I like what the term uses, flow, like flowing into the next pieces and going forward and just being as a CEO. I think what you've touched on are just true like gems of that. So my question to you is that, you know, as you're kind of moving through, what, you know, what do you see for companies and like in order to become more proactive about bias? Like what are, like, what do you see in the industry as it's moving forward with cog bias, like going forward?
I think there's two ways to consider it. As a company, whether you're early stage or you're a large corporate, the key is to understand that you are flawed, and that's okay. Obviously, a lot of the big, and I always caution this to early stage startups who are selling to enterprise. I'm like, you're saying that you can do something better, faster, this and that, to people that have made their entire career, lives, 30 plus years in some cases, and these companies that are so stupid and big and slow that somehow are worth tens of billions of dollars. Being stupid, big, and slow. Clearly, that's not the approach. The key is, a company has to admit that it has this fault, because it's the same reason they use Qualtrics for marketing research and all this stuff. Why? Because they clearly saw that they had a fault about how they do marketing research, maybe how they develop their questions, how they issue stuff, how they send surveys, full stop, right? So from that perspective, where I see like a company like ours, we've realized really fast that it's not a good idea to sell another screen to people, which is why we're going to live within your software. We're going to go within Qualtrics. We're going to live within your browsers, your conversation tools such as Zoom and Google Talk. And you'll be able to see the transcription and figure out if you went in the wrong direction, or figure out if the question you asked was forcing the person to answer in a way that wasn't authentic. So you don't really know what that is they want. And do it in real time. We're going to plug into AI agents, so that way we can eliminate the idea of BS or hallucinations from perspective of when you're having the agent service a customer. And, you know, when that, I think the scariest thing for a lot of companies now is they're putting out all these agents, as much as they like, oh yeah, go this, it's the future. They all have this in the back of their head concern, like, you know, as humans, again, remember we talked about, we're used to human faults. So somebody makes a mistake and they're human, you're like, okay. But then you can't imagine an AI agent not representing your company properly, because once you put in, this should be an absolute, right?
Right.
But it never is. It kind of fluctuates because it's built on LLM. So having that better grasp on that is important. For as companies, we see, for in general, as companies, I see more and more leaning into decision making, because companies are being forced to stretch their budgets more, not because they don't have the money, but because there's so much more to do, because there's a lot more competition. There's a lot more areas they want to attack. All sorts of reasons. So all those things that are important now, it's becoming more and more critical to make the right decision the first time. Because going back to the drawing board can be a life or death thing. And you really don't want to do it if you can help it. And for us, we are creating the underpinning for that, the very foundational base. We want to get to a point where you don't know we exist, but we're always there. Because ultimately, that's when you know you've built something that's a movement and a revolution, not just a product.
Mm. And then with that, as you kind of go through, that's the vision of it. What have you seen as working really well for cog bias right now? And, you know, and then what are you seeing that's being the biggest challenge?
I'll start with the challenge, because challenges are more fun, right? And also, I think it's important for people to kind of get a grasp on the idea of, you know, praise is bad in a lot of ways. You need to hear the negatives, because you can actually do something about them.
Absolutely.
Praise, you're just like, oh, thank you, thank you. The biggest challenge is explain to people that this exists, right? They all know it exists to a degree, but understanding that they can change it is still an element. And this goes back to the foundational idea. How do you get people to have authentic demand for your product, right? Well, you have to see them reaching for it. But the key is that they have to understand that they have the problem. So avoiding bias in them while creating that, that's been a challenge. It's also, you know, being first to the party, in this case, this kind of industry, this thing we're building, we're first. There's been other companies that have tried, but they're usually limiting themselves to HR or recruiting tools. So they're limiting the ability, their things that they can do, and they're not using expert data models. So the reliability is questionable at best. So being first to the party means that you have to explain the market. And from perspective, when you're dealing with investors, they've never seen it before. And if they've never seen it, they don't have a pattern that they can follow. And so it's very important not to get scared away by that, because I think there's always going to be a thing of where people's like, well, who's going to invest in this? This is so new and ridiculous. I'm like, at a certain point in time, people thought what was new and ridiculous was the electric car. You know, Tesla was new and ridiculous, and then it wasn't, you know. And there's no way am I comparing ourselves with any kind of company of that size, but the element is still the same. We're building something that's uniquely special, but we're also comfortable with the idea that if a large player comes in trying to do the same thing that we're doing, I'm perfectly good with that. I love the challenge, but now it'll solve my problem of having to explain the market. Because I could say, look at them. They have all this business, but somehow they felt the need to go here. I wonder why. As far as the things that are, you know, successful for us, we've we've developed the capability, other than obviously the plugins that we're putting in, and that's gotten a lot of positive responses from people. One of the biggest things that we've discovered, and we discovered it in our beta. By the way, our beta is available to anybody. All you have to do is go to cogbias.ai, and if you go on LinkedIn and you find me, Anatoly Shilman, you'll see I put out a passcode that will give you a free month every single time. And what's cool about it is, you know, we discover things about people all the time. We found out that people love education. And here's what I mean. When we released our beta, at first we were like, oh, beta, you know, so it's going to give you some recommendation. It's not as deep on features. It's as the best we could do at the time to prove the concept of this thing can possibly work. And what we discovered, though, is people were just as, if not more, interested in the explanation of why a certain question is biased as they were in the rephrases that would solve the problem. In certain cases, when we checked with our beta users, at times we had over 55% who were preferring just the educational piece. They're like, oh, no, I'm still using my question. I just wanted to know what's wrong with it. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Well, they said, well, because if you think about it, obviously you can rephrase it to eliminate that. But I love the question. I do. But now I know what to expect, potentially. And understanding that there's going to be a fault. And I think that's the big key. So we've started, our system can now generate reports based on all sorts of stuff. Like, for instance, just for entertainment purposes, if you ever flown Delta, you get an email after the flight saying, how was your flight? Right? It's a survey that's generated by Qualtrics. So we had our system pick one apart. And, you know, hint to Delta, we sent it to them just for fun. Over 57% of all the elements in their questions throughout the survey are harmful to their objective of getting the right information from the client. Because the biases are pointing people in different directions instead of asking for, well, how was your experience really?
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, well, maybe they don't care. I would say, yeah, potentially, but I highly doubt that because the Qualtrics was expensive. All this stuff is expensive. You're not spending tens of millions of dollars and not caring. The problem is, again, because if you can't conceive of what the solution looks like, you're left to your own devices. So, you know, our goal is to show them that there is a solution and to explain that. So the reports have been a really big thing for us because now people can see in a quantitative and a qualitative way. So these are the answers you should be expecting because it's the opposite of what you actually want to find out. Or it's pointing the person in a different direction. Or it's putting a person into a way too positive a mindset when you're trying to find out what issues they may have had. Or way too negative a mindset when you're trying to find out what actually worked. Because ultimately what ends up happening is what we're trying to get to is the product truth, right? It's not the like truth as we know it. It's product truth. It's what makes the person feel good about the certain product or service that you deliver to them. And what makes them feel bad. And what they wish you really, what else was available. Because quite often, if you just ask like, you know, one of the most interesting questions I remember I used to ask during my customer discovery for when I was at Flashpoint was, is there a question that you think that you feel I should have asked you? And well, sometimes people would not know how to answer that. But sometimes they're like, yeah, you know, I really thought you would ask me about this. And I was like, how come? And it takes them on a whole other tangent. Now I'm not pointing them. I'm not telling them to go there. They're giving me literally the authentic opportunity to find out of why this was top of mind for them. And why they were so surprised that I never asked that question. And because quite often, we can't detect what's top of mind for people unless we let them tell us. But if we ask them, well, you know, oh, so tell me about your number one problem. Well, like depends on the day. But top of mind is very different. You know, or sometimes I would ask questions like, hey, what keeps you up at night? And you'd get some random answers because I wouldn't tell them what keeps you up at night about your SaaS provider or blah, blah, blah. Because that's, again, too on the nose, and people will quite often be like, you know, they'll go on a tangent. But you'll be surprised how often they'll get to the thing that you are actually trying to talk to them about. Because, and if they don't, I can promise you they're not buying your product. The reason why is because they're not reaching for it. They're not. For most people to make the decision to buy a product, in general, we have to have consider when you buy a pair of shoes. You go through a whole decision tree in your mind. It's the same as an enterprise. You are your own enterprise. So it's the same thing as an enterprise company doing. Their decision process to even champion an idea of what you're selling, they have to be like, this is killing us. And here's the solution in our hands. And why is this important? Because this is another objective that we got to change and improve this. Because very few people actually ask what the annual objectives are of the people you're talking to. They'll tell you quite a bit. They won't tell you all the stuff because they think some of it's personal, right? But on the perspective of, our company's been really trying to figure out how to reduce waste. Oh, tell me more. And now it gets into the tangent of what's really top of mind for them. Versus you saying like, so tell me, have you experienced blah, 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 blah? Because when you do that, what you do is you actually write a script for them. And now they're going to read that script for you. So they'll tell you all the stuff. Absolutely, it happens. And then you're like, great, we have a solution. And then you're going to go home to your co-founders and be like, this is it. They want it. They never said they wanted it. They never wrote a check. They never made a commitment to purchase the product. You know, it's like my kids. If they bring me a plate full of mud and tell me it's a pie, I'm biased. I'll have to tell them it's the greatest pie I ever had. And I'll have to tell them to make it for the rest of the neighborhood. At which point they're going to go to their friends and be like, all right, you're hired. We're going to go buy that factory over there and go raise some money. We got ourselves a company. That's kind of it, right? So those are the elements that you want to try to avoid. And those are the things that we fight against every single day. Because every time we get some kind of great comment or positive response, I almost have to be paranoid and be like, wait a minute. Let's make sure we understand what's being said to us. But it's kind of, that's the stuff that's important.
And I love that, like with all of these, and I like how now you've kind of put in the reports now to really give that individual being able to get that assessment, but also to think of these things. So where do you see, or Anatoly, like where you see Cog Bias being in the next 6 to 12 months as you're kind of scaling?
In the next 6 to 12 months, we are going to be, our goal is to capture several hundred Qualtrics customers.
Okay.
That's the first and foremost. We're looking to scale within the Qualtrics universe and also within the browser universe. Again, I think the world's evolving where trying to create your own platform and try to sell it independently can happen, but it's problematic. So it has to be really unique and special. In our case, we always like to compare ourselves favorably to a company like Grammarly. As a standalone, we may not look like much, but when we're added to other products, that's when the magic happens. You know, whether it's your emails, whether it's your Qualtrics, Medallia, whatever it is you're using, your browsers, your word processors, whatever. We're living in the background there and we're available to you at all times. Our goal, it'll sound weird, in the next 6 to 12 months, we want to become less visible.
Right.
And less obvious. If we do those things, that means we're winning.
And you know, and I love that. I really want to, because you've touched on a really big point of, and which not most touch on is that bias of having them coming into and asking, those right questions, coming into the point of where it's not always having the yes man, but now you're putting this in the AI. So, you know, and so this has been great. I'll ask, a question of like what you see, AI coming in, but as the conversation has grown and been more dynamic, and I really loved your approach as a leader and like with your experience, I want to add, like, what would you say for an actionable step for like for anyone that's on a leadership or for a company as a whole, like as a startup or enterprise, what can they do this week to start surfacing and reducing bias in terms of their own decision making?
First and foremost, if they have a knee-jerk response or reaction or decision, stop themselves there and figure out what's making them say that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some things are obvious, right? Like, we had a factory breakdown. Oh, we should replace those parts. But then you can later find out what happened, right? Right now, you're just trying to solve the problem, make sure there's no factory breakdown. But in other cases, I also always tell people, do the postmortem. Figure out what made your decision good or bad last time. If it was successful, what factors did you consider? If it was not successful, what were the true causes of failure? Not just like, the customer didn't want it. That's the failure. Stupid customer. No, the customer is the smartest thing out there because they somehow know how to survive. Us as executives, we have to constantly think whether our customers internal or external, the situation is always the same. We're trying to provide them with something that they can't be without. And if that's the case, we have to always wonder to ourselves. So every decision we make along the way, whether it's in our product roadmap, our sales roadmap, has to be based on more than just, I've seen this before, or pattern recognition. Quite often we fall back on the idea, I've been doing this for 20 years. I mean, You know, there's no new news. And my argument has always been every day is new news because you're dealing with different people, different individuals, different situations. You know, people are older, people are wiser, people are crazier. Who knows what it is? So you always have to kind of go back to the fundamental of why am I making this decision? And is this decision that I'm making because it's good for the company? And is it going to be good for my customers? Because if it's good for my customers, it'll be good for the company. But if it's good for the company, it's not always good for my customers. Those things are crucial. And it requires a little bit of introspection. That's why I always say you need something else. You need an additive. You can't just, it'd be easy to say, like, I'm just going to sit down, pick apart all my decisions. We're not that introspective. Let's be clear. You know, we all have a certain form of ADD about how we deal with stuff like this. And quite often, we don't want to admit when we screwed up. Whether consciously or unconsciously, it's not our fault, right? Or, oh, if he didn't do that, it would have been still there, blah, blah, blah. No. Especially if you're an executive, the buck stops with you. Always, always, always. Yes, there could be stakeholders involved and other things that slowed the process down, but you can't just think to yourself, well, they said no and they're idiots or jerks. No, quite often they said no because it doesn't align with the annual objectives they have. And now you have to find out, what is it about my thing that doesn't align with their objectives? And is it a question of objectives not aligning within the company to make it progress forward? Or is it a question of, in this case, we had my project, there's something faulty about it. Because it could be either one of those two. The faster you start understanding why decisions are made, or the background to them, the context to them, the better it'll be. So the context to your own decisions, the context to other people's decisions, obviously you won't know everything, but you'll have enough to make directional moves.
Right. And I think that's the biggest piece of it to understand that. And then, you know, this has been great, Anatoly, just on your perspective again of this and what cog bias is really going to bring forward. I'm really looking forward to it as you guys move forward. So for folks that are, you know, where can they learn more? I know you put in with cog bias and like now they have it to where they can go in, they can do the password and they can get that. But where can they learn more about the company, about yourself and your journey? And then what can they grab from, what can they expect in utilizing that free trial part of it?
Yep. So you can visit cogbias.ai to learn more about us. Obviously, you can also follow me on LinkedIn, Anatoly Shilman. I spot all sorts of random things, but usually connected to what we're doing and also about leadership. And quite often, you know, I'm not afraid to be pragmatic and also not afraid to comment on things. So, you know, there's a big hype cycle going on with AI, and I don't buy it.
Yeah.
I don't buy it at all. My belief is that ultimately you have to dissect things and not be like, oh my God, I was able to create, you know, like the big thing is vibe coding now.
Yeah.
And I'm the first person to tell you it's great for concepts. It's awful in execution. Absolutely awful. So anybody who thinks, well, oh, vibe coding has eliminated developers. That's just a nice clickbait thing. So don't read those. If you see a post like that, that's the thing you don't read. That's the waste of your time. You want to be more economical with your time? Don't read stuff like that. No, it didn't. All it did was give non-technical founders an easier pathway of checking their concept before they got to go get a technical co-founder or get some developers to really develop a fully functional thing. So those are the big things. So for me, like cogbias.ai, you can learn about us. You can visit us. You can follow us on LinkedIn. Follow me on LinkedIn. You'll see quite often I put out the passcodes for a free month here, free couple months there, new feature updates and stuff like that. Feel free to reach out to me anytime, anatoly.shilman@cogbias.ai. I'm happy to talk to anyone. And oh, here's one thing for founders that's really, really, really important. Yes, time is finite, but what's most finite is our ability to get to learn new things. So that's why I always tell everybody, and I always say the same way. I always say it to you right now. If you think there are people I should be talking to, let me know. And I will talk to them. I'm a sponge. And the idea of being a sponge is there's no such thing as a bad conversation. There are conversations that are not going to be useful to you in the context of what you're doing, but you will learn something new every single time. And that's going to be value in itself.
And that's phenomenal. Anatoly, like, thank you so much for coming on. Like, this is, I could talk to you so much more just on just leadership and just like more on just on the scaling part. I could go on, but for the sake of the combo, I've got to end it. But, you know, thanks again. For those that are watching that kind of listened through episode, appreciate you for sticking through. Look forward to liking, subscribing to the AI Advantage show, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. that this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more No Fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at solonox.net.